Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Adrian Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, you beautiful people.
Justin Robert Young.
Hi, it's me, Justin Robert Young.
All right, gentlemen. First up, let's talk about the 800-pound tauntaun in the room. We are not going to make this show about Rogue One. We already know that there's been reviews about Rogue One, and there's people talking about Rogue One. We're not going to address Rogue One. This is going to be a totally Rogue One free episode. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
So we're not going to talk about any of those reviews, right? We're not going to talk about how glowing they are.
We're still not going to talk about the fact that this is essentially a movie embodiment of everything I loved about the expanded universe. Like, all that has come to roost, and it's in many ways the first Star Wars novel movie ever created.
We're not going to talk about the fact that I'm excited for a Star Wars movie and a Spider-Man reboot, proving conclusively that I never learned lessons.
We're not going to talk about Rogue One. That's the whole point. Okay, we're just going to be Rogue One free, because you're going to get a lot of Rogue One talk, and we want to create this sort of a safe space from that. Okay.
Yeah.
So instead, let's talk about all the technology in Star Wars that could be true and may happen sooner than we think.
Right on. I want to say a 99% Invisible about it. I forgot the name for it. Maybe Bryce will have magic wizard powers. But the practice of making up excuses for things that don't make sense in science fiction movies, things that seem to contradict it. And the example they talked about is, you know, the dogfight scene in the original Star Wars, where you got TIE fighters swinging all around. And of course, they're making all this sound in space, right? You know, wah, wah. And the workaround, the kludge to fix it was, it's like, well, if you were targeting, it would probably be helpful to know relative positions to you of where these enemy aircraft are, and also to be able to identify enemy aircraft by signature sounds. So it would make sense that part of the weapon systems on the Millennium Falcon would include an array of speakers that would simulate with vectors of where different ships are, and that each individual ship by its class would have a distinct sound that would come across as sounds.
That's what I'm talking about. Although I have a better theory.
Oh yeah, what's that?
Well, remember, they've got force fields, right? They've got shields.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and one of the ways you would do a shield, you actually would do a shield, is you would use some sort of magnetic field to contain like a gas or a plasma around you, right? And actually, plasma aero shields are a real thing that NASA's been working on for how to do reentry into like a planetary atmosphere. Instead of having to have a bunch of heat shields, you would use this big plasma aero shield that would absorb that. But you could also use that in space to absorb like certain wavelengths of energy depending on the gas. So if you've got this big bubble that's your shield, what happens when something moves through this gas?
Well, it would explode and make sounds, or
make sounds.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can get sounds.
You know, that would also explain why Han Solo gets out to make repairs. They're sitting on an asteroid that happens to be, you know, spoiler alert, they're inside the belly of a giant space worm. But he just gets out with nothing but a little thing over his mask. If there was constant, persistent plasma shields, there would be a bubble of atmosphere around the Millennium Falcon.
See what I'm saying? It's easy to say, no, it can't be done. The real test is to try to figure out how it can be possible.
Yeah. I mean, like, you could just take milk and add blue food coloring to it. Boom, blue milk.
That's all right. Now this is crazy.
No.
Justin.
No.
You can do that. I mean, listen, it's a miracle, a Star Wars miracle in your house right now, folks. That's what the Weird Things podcast gives you.
Do you know about the stain, the blue milk stain on the floor of the actual kitchen in where they shot the original scene?
Oh, no.
No.
Really?
So funny fact is that if you were to go visit, it's like some hotel or whatever in Tunisia. If you go there and you look on the floor, you'll actually see a blue stain on there because some fan decided it would be great to bring milk and blue food dye there and go do that and to drink blue milk and actually ended up staining the floor.
Oh, so it was just some fan. It wasn't like the production team from back in the day. I would love to think.
No, it was
like
a fan who then later on went to direct Rogue One.
No kidding!
Wow.
Yep. Gareth Edwards, he and his girlfriend went to go visit the location. This is before he was even going to be doing the movie. You know, he said, how cool would it be to drink blue milk? And he's got his blue food. Oh, yeah. Oh, God, I got it everywhere. I'm so excited.
That's amazing.
Oh, they'll never let me direct a Star Wars movie now.
another workaround idea, like in real life. And this is not my idea, but it was a suggestion in Michio Kaku's Science of the Impossible, I think. He took the idea of telekinesis, the ability to move objects with your mind, and instead, you know, picture a room where, whether by magnetic fields or by basically, you can move objects in the room. And then separate from that, imagine brain scanning technology where you can know when you know, we already have quadriplegics who are able to move a cursor just by thinking about moving. So it's not too far a step. You know, I guess a rudimentary version we could do right now would be if you think about different objects in the room, maybe like pictures falling off the ceiling, falling off the walls or whatever. And then that happens as you think about it.
No disrespect to him, but I think his explanations are the lamest ones I've ever heard. And they're much better ones.
Okay.
And you're right.
I'm sorry. I'll start here. Let me give you the dance floor, maestro. Take it away.
You're right. If you want to do that now. But I mean, like, you know, we talk about nanobots and stuff like that. And I never, like, I mean, I don't think any of us was really happy when we heard the term midichlorians, because in Star Wars, we're kind of like, no, we like the kind of magic. We don't need to have science. But if you wanted to have that, like, nanobots and stuff, I mean, when we're reading, like, Peter F. Hamilton books and stuff, there's stuff in there that's so much cooler and stuff that you could have, you know, little nanobots and stuff moving things, you know, that are like, that's the Force.
So what do you think, Andrew, is in Star Wars that is close for us to replicate on some level?
So I put the Force for the last thing we should discuss because, yeah, but I do agree that, like, if you wanted to understand how it could be done now, absolutely, yeah. Like, you could say, like, well, we could create that effect, you know, with this rigged room and stuff and all that, but how do we get to the closer? So I thought, let's talk low-hanging fruit, robots.
Okay.
What do you guys think?
They're not possible. They'll never happen.
All right. Next topic. Let's move right on.
So one of the most curious things to me is, why would you imbue robots with personality? Like, that's one of the things that doesn't make sense, right? It's like you want them to do things and do it right the first time. And it seems like all of them should be exactly identical and they should all be interconnected. But if I was going to try to figure it out, we know from Matt Ridley's book, the Theory of Everything, is that what it is? Or The Evolution of Everything, that he talks about how ideas essentially mate and have sex with each other and create new ideas. So in this incredibly diverse galaxy, I could imagine a world where there's a benefit to make sure no two robots are exactly the same. Because as a result, then whatever situation or difficulties a planet faces, they're going to have one or two uniquely qualified robots to help do that. Does that make sense? So, in other words, from an evolutionary standpoint, cloning is a very poor strategy. It's good to get the numbers, but it's very, very bad because a disease vector could take everything out. And if that one thing is ill adapted for its environment, it gets totally, you know, destroyed. Whereas a highly heterogeneous collection of organisms is robust. And so maybe in this world where you have robot servants that all are doing jobs, essentially slavery, I guess, but it seems like maybe there would be a benefit in the large scale to make sure no two of them were the same.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, you talk about, like, with the astromechs, like R2-D2 and BB-8, and how they bond with the pilots, not unlike police dogs do, you know. Yeah. And police dogs have their own personalities, their own takes, and that becomes, you know, it's their co-pilot. And you're going to want to have some bits of personality there if you're out there on this long mission, you know, fighting the Empire, et cetera. And so, yeah, but we do get to the fact that, you know, if you dig down into it, they are kind of slaves. But technology-wise, would you think that, you know, we're probably closer than ever to?
Well, I think the question with droids as we see them in Star Wars is less, can we get them to look and feel like they did in the movie or do in the movies, and kind of more, do we need them to do that? You know, are there smarter ways to solve these problems in more cheaper, replaceable smaller solutions than just having an actual other humanoid, you know, a shaped figure walking around and doing things with hands.
So you're saying we won't make those things? We're not close to being able to do that?
No, no, no. I think, I mean, I don't know. It seems like we're fairly close. I mean, you know, we have enough of, you know, AI built into things now that we interact with it on a fairly regular basis. I mean, if there's, you know, in I think all of our homes, we yell at the A word that, you know, for the Amazon Echo to shut up. You know, we talk to Siri all the time. You know, it'd just be a matter of making those kind of walk around machines cheap enough that people would want to buy them.
Well, how weird is it? This is what's fascinating now, because like when I read Harry Potter, I always thought the thing about Harry Potter that is disturbing. The thing about Harry Potter was like, this is a lot like a post singularity civilization would be with Potter, you know, like kids having magic spells and stuff. Now there is one word that the three of us will not say because we will invoke a genie.
Exactly. Yeah. No. And people will get upset, you know, and I don't blame them because they might be playing us on that thing. And people get upset when you say that word followed by please buy 50 rolls of toilet paper.
So let me propose a counterpoint, because you're right. It does seem like maybe lazy writing, or like, oh, of course the robots are going to be human shaped and have human personalities or whatever. But I would say that if you want, if what you want is a highly versatile individual, then number one, it should have human personality, and that's a natural language interface with other humans, which is who it's working for. But more importantly, I think there's a reason humans kind of won the evolution game, and I think part of it is our shape. And you know, a dog will never ever be able to get evolved to a point where it has can create space travel, because it just simply cannot manipulate the pieces to do this. You know, maybe a tentacled something, but you know, there's an advantage to tell me, am I remembering this correctly? No animal on Earth can run farther than a human. Like there are plenty that can go faster, but none have the distance running capability of humans. And that's largely because of our bipedal design. So it makes sense that there's an energy efficiency that would bring us to human shaped robots.
Yeah. It's like, there's something like that. Like we can out marathon horses. Maybe you, Brian, not me, can out marathon horses and stuff and do that, you know. But then, so yeah, there is a versatility, and that makes sense too. Like what I love about the Star Wars universe is that like some things are really old, some things are new. You're not going to be wanting to rely too much on cloud-based computing and stuff, you know. Like what's great about when you go back and watch Star Wars, by the way, is this is 1977, a movie that was largely shot in 1975, and R2-D2 is hacking into the Death Star mainframe computer system. You know, yeah. He's hacking the system, cracking it, and doing all that. And I'm like, man, it's like the first movie I ever can recall there was hacking and stuff in there.
Yeah, well, and similar, you know, around that same time, Westworld was one of the first movies before there was even words for computer viruses. It talked about the idea of a glitch that spread from one robot to the next.
And computers designing computers, you know, that was, they said, it's so complicated. How could this happen? We don't even know how it works. Computers are designing computers, which is, you know, brilliant. So I would say, we're going to say that, yeah, if we wanted to have those sort of robots and stuff, we're going to end up with those kinds of robots. That does not seem that far-fetched at all, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the spirit of justifying, because this is a fun game, how would you justify, or can any of us justify some of the more ridiculous shapes for the robots? Like that one that the one that looks like a refrigerator with legs plopping forward. Oh,
well, we don't know what environment it's supposed to work in. Is this something that's walking on the exterior of a giant spaceship designed to do something? Is it, you know, is it carrying a lot of data? Like one of the things that Amazon has, this new service where if you want to export your data to the cloud, they'll actually park like a tractor trailer truck in front of your server facility, and you transfer your data there because that's faster than trying to have a fast internet connection.
Wow.
So I mean, it could be a mobile power unit. I mean, that's obviously, we know, yeah, they just sort of made that stuff up. But the fun part is just use your brain to say, how could this be true? What could you do?
Yeah, you know, and I'll tell you what, if you look at what, you know, before he gets waylaid by this wild, you know, wizard boy and his crazy journey, like the idea of C-3PO as just a diplomat robot, you know, doesn't seem far-fetched. Like, you know, if you wanted, if these things were just gaudy, expensive ways that you could have a presence discuss things with other people and translate, like, you know, you could certainly see in the age of Donald Trump, a very, very highly priced gold robot, you know, seems fully plausible in the highest levels.
If you're
going
to go to some remote backwater civilization and go talk to the local king or something like that, to have your emissary look like him instead of holding, you know, Google Now in front of their face.
Exactly. Yeah. I think like there's part of it's like, okay, if you were to have it in the White House, maybe an AI that didn't need a physical form kind of makes sense. But certainly, to take it out and talk to people and demonstrate power and wealth and translate, like, that seems legit to me.
The White House droid, that's a very interesting idea. All right, let's move right along. Hologram. So when they first had, when Star Wars first came out, you saw Princess Leia being projected. There was a lot of, if you read a lot of like science fiction, science stuff back in the day, a lot of people who loved hard science fiction actually tore Star Wars apart because like, this is a hard science. You can't have, you know, holograms project in the middle of the air. But
whoopsie. This one's an easy one, a slam dunk for our friend Jaime, who put together a successfully funded Kickstarter for the Holovect, which works by magic. It works by the Force, as best I can tell. But
We've been seeing some cool stuff, including our buddy Jaime, who's working on stuff that uses, you know, you can use sound waves, you can use particulates, vapor, things like that. You can actually project holograms in the middle. And we're not talking about the Tupac thing that's just on a scrim. We're talking about actual volumetric stuff, and there's several really cool things going into that. And Jaime's made one that's, you know, from without the resources of a major, huge corporation kind of thing. But there's also been like the Firefly voxel system, some really cool things in this area. So, you know, and this is where it starts from. You know, what happens when you start putting hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars of research into developing specialty chips and other things like that, is that you go from, and that look, we're looking at some images right now of the system, the Jaime built, and it's awesome. You're watching this cube float in the middle of the air. And once you're able to make these things more powerful, you know, you're going to have, you know, Princess Leia saying, help me, Obi-Wan. And
I think this is more a question about where it fits in our life rather than whether or not it will continue to progress from where it is now.
Okay. What would you use it for?
I mean, the initial thought for it is to do, if you want to be kind of productive with it, to have some kind of a interactive sort of, you know, for blueprints or you know, like basically to do the stuff that we find really cool in VR now without the VR.
Like, I think that's interesting. So like, let's say you're prototyping something, you know, it's going to take 2 hours to print on your 3D printer, and you just want to get an idea if the mock-up is correct or a preview of how it looks. You could put on the goggles and walk around and say, yeah, that looks right. But this, as for a simple low fidelity preview that's instantly on, that everyone in the boardroom can glimpse, this probably would be the method to beat.
Let's go further out. Let's imagine a really, really high def version of this. Okay. And I would say, like, remember when Microsoft showed us the HoloLens and they showed us that demo of that, and we're watching them play Minecraft on the middle of the table. And a cool thing that we had in, you know, by the way, Star Wars, actually, I think it appeared first in Future World, though, was the idea of like playing like this three-dimensional chess. Right. But if you say, like, we've seen these examples now of augmented reality Minecraft.
Yeah.
You know, so what happens when you can scale these holographic projectors up and have them around your house?
That I think is, you know, just kind of a game changer. And I think you saw it a lot in, oh, man, what was the movie Cloud Atlas? That the idea that like everyone will live in closets that will look like mansions because you can scale the difference of like what all your everything around you kind of looks like at all times.
I absolutely believe that, man. I can't see any way for that not to be one of the most popular cosmopolitan, because think about it. You're close to everywhere instantly. You get the feeling of having a big fancy house, but you know, you're three steps to anywhere once you step outside.
I still think we'll continue to expand in every possible dimension, but plus we'll also add that too.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't necessarily. I think that that is kind of tied more into the idea that, you know, we will continue to run out of space, which I think is been one of the more consistently overblown kind of things. And
oh no, no. And by the way, I'm not saying that we'll do it out of necessity. We'll do it because that's what we want. I mean, there's a reason all of humanity is flocking to city centers and a more honeycomb-like existence is because we love being near other humans and we love convenience and choice. And this would be a way to maximize it. And you know, if you, I can totally envision people deciding, well, I mean, I could spend $500,000 on an actual mansion, or you know, $50,000 a year for a virtual mansion is, or $50,000 total for a virtual mansion is the way to go.
Well, I mean, and even now, you know, you're looking at you know, the whole tiny home craze,
yeah,
right, and you know, it stands to reason that this kind of projection would be would certainly just be the next step there, right?
Mm-hmm. So we could see certainly the applications there, and it could be a combination, like, you know, of volumetric holograms. You know, I think we're going to probably see pretty soon, the next couple of years, just video, like, as we have LED video projectors have gotten cheaper and they last so much longer, is just putting them in a couple corners of your house and to start throwing images around the walls and things like that without even before we go to 3D, but just to be able to do that alone could really, we're already doing that with our hue, like our color lighting.
Yeah.
You know, and then the next step up there is just to start using projection bulbs and stuff like that, and to start doing projection mapping, you know, in our own homes.
Well, and now, and setting up these cues that respond to, you know, like I could totally envision in the next 5 years, let's say you replace, you know, instead of hues, some other light that is constantly projecting a sky overhead. So it's like you're able to look up and know, even though there's no windows in your apartment or this area of the room, you know what it's going on outside. You know before you even leave that, you know, well, it's drizzly or it's nighttime or whatever.
Imagine being able to do this show in front of a full or just have a wall that's projected onto and getting rid of the idea of a screen at a wall. And we're looking at the faces of all of our lovely listeners.
Oh, that would fundamentally change things because it's hard.
How would I get into the front row?
Everyone's in the front row.
No.
What? No. Oh, with money? I look over and Bryce is doing this.
Get into the front row with Patreon.
Oh, no.
Can someone else take this plug?
You would get in the front row with Patreon.com. Head on over to Patreon.com/weirdthings and become a weird supporter. Only $1 an episode, man. You will never, ever notice that on your bill. And every time you do notice it, you'll smile and think, I bought those guys a cup of coffee that they have to split three ways because I'm very cheap. But look at this,
man.
We all
got the same mouth sore because we did that.
We are so very close to a milestone. We are just $4 away from $500 an episode. We have never crossed this boundary since they rejiggered the Patreon setup and made it more accurate. If you look at us at graftreon.com, this is a big, big moment, man. You guys have kept us completely on the regs, and it's all because of you. Thank you.
And also, thank you so much, especially during December. We know that this is a tight time for money for so many people. The fact that our number hasn't fallen and it has in fact risen is just such an amazing testament to the support we get for this show. So thank you guys very much.
Much, much, much appreciated. All right. Let's talk land speeders and speeder bikes. I'm gonna flash back to the Michael Crichton movie Runaway, right? And I don't know if you remember in that movie, Gene Simmons was the bad guy. There was this situation where this house, some robot, a domestic robot, got hold of a gun and fired the gun. And the cops are outside. And they don't know what to do. Like, it's too dangerous to go in there. What do we do? And they have this little device. I remember watching this as a kid. I'm like, I don't know if that's really probable. They had this little device, this little hovering thing that went. And it flew into the house and it had a camera and they could see what was going on.
That sounds like crazy talk. No way can a flying camera exist.
Yeah, I'm like, I can't find the things at Radio Shack to make this.
Yeah, dude, just ahead of their time. Michael Crichton, he should write books.
You know, Brian, you got a bit of a wry smile, you know, on your face for this whole flying camera discussion. You know, it seems like maybe you got some thoughts on this.
Not yet. What I have is trouble. I bought a used DJI Inspire 1 because we wanted to get some aerial shots for the Modern Rogue. And there was a great price on used one. It's only been used like 9 times. Also doesn't work at all, so it's off to get repaired. So I bought a project is what I bought.
Oh no.
So we'll see.
I'm literally flying to Florida and I have Wi-Fi and I got a call from Brian that I can't take because I'm in the air. And then I just get a text message that says, if I shouldn't buy this drone, you're the last person to talk me out of it.
Yeah.
On your hands. Bye.
Well, and what's funny is the next person I wrote was the guy who had one. I was like, hey, you have a DJI Inspire 1. How do you like it? Should I buy one? And he goes, no, you should buy mine. And I did. And again, the price was great. We'll see about whether or not whether or not it works.
Hmm. So we've seen now one of the things that made drones and quadcopters and things like that work is as battery power density is improved. You know, lithium ion has made you could not run these things with lead acid batteries, right? But with lithium ion, we've had this improved ratio, and as we start to have better technologies like supercapacitors and technology like that, where we can get even more power out, we're going to see the lifting capabilities of that. We're going to find out that you can do to make something float. A couple ways you can do it. You can use the big quadcopters like that. You can use a bunch of smaller ducted fans and stuff. There's another theoretical thing is if you start to make things go down to almost a microchip level, you might be able to create surfaces that just bend the air around it, either mechanically electrically.
Wow. So basically like a billion little flapping wings that keep it aloft.
Like that, or look up if Bryce can pull up electric lifter. And this was one of these things UFO crazy people kind of get into, and that is how you use electrostatic wind to lift things. And you could, in theory, maybe make surfaces that use this to do that, so you have no moving parts.
Well, that if you've ever seen one, it looks like a triangle made of foil, and then there's a thin wire going off to a power source, and then you flip it, and the thing kind of hovers over ground, and people inaccurately call it, levitation or anti-gravity or whatever.
Here we go.
But really, it's just power exerting a downward force that causes this thing to float.
Ionocraft is the name I'm saying. Ionocraft.
Great. Cool.
Oh my God, which is just great because it does just look like a 1950s Ed Wood UFO when it lifts off.
Yeah, but in principle, I mean, once we crack the power issue, it seems like that's not out of the question.
Yeah, so we can even get away from what we just saw there was, as Brian described, kind of looked like just a kind of a box kite, but a triangular, and you can do a square and do a triangular. So it's a three poles going upright with what looks like three sticks of chewing gum, you know, aluminum foil with the foil on them attached to the sides, and then a wire above the top. And what happens is it's creating a charge, which charges an air molecule, and that creates an ion, which then gets pulled down towards the aluminum there, creating this upward sort of draft. And so it's electric. It's an electric form of lift. And we haven't done we don't know, of course, what the military has been doing to this kind of technology, but with the right kind of energy, and you could use beamed energy with right amount of energy in there, is you have no moving parts, yet you're still having things that can float. And that, if you put, imagine, you know, building, you know, a dozen of those things interlocking inside of each other, and you could have a system that is, you know, you could build some sort of like ducted jet. So we're going to say, I'm going to say if we can get enough power, you can have things that kind of looked a lot like hover bikes and land speeders.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's crazy. That's a crazy concept.
So I got one. What's up with the complete lack of ballistics in the Star Wars galaxy? Is this a case where it's like, you know, the galaxy's got a slightly different set of rules of physics or for some reason... You know, gunpowder don't work. Why would every society kind of independently apparently discover blaster technology?
I think that's an example of, you know, one of the problems you have in any kind of munitions. If you can reduce it to just one thing where it's electric or whatever, that's the ideal. And if you, instead of having to buy your bullets and your gunpowder, if you had, you just need to be able to charge this thing and it works.
Although I take it back. There was one type of ballistics, and it was apparently effective enough to destroy the Empire on the forest moon of Endor when they threw rocks at the stormtroopers.
So I would say it's just a matter of they have a more superior form of technology. If all you need is energy to power the thing, and that way you're not going to have to worry about running out of bullets, just have charges.
Oh, and you know what? Actually, in a society, and I'm trying to write out the highly diverse prequels, but considering that the Empire is the bad guy, you could picture that in this kind of communist, fascist society, it's like, no, the great leader has decided that blasters are the best weapons. All weapons will be blasters. You kind of picture that kind of thing happening.
Well, I mean, again, I think that we will move towards all energy-based weapons in the future. I think that's where we're actually progressing towards.
Interesting.
And I think that, and you could do things, too, that people are like, well, how come you can watch the light beam move? Like, who says it's not a bunch of compressed air turned into plasma? And we've heard him say plasma blasts or whatever. So I'm saying it's not a laser pistol as much as it's like, ever see the vortex cannon where it creates that vortex of air? And you feel like, you know, you could do that and you could create a super high energy plasma that hits you like that. And that would not feel good, I bet.
Yeah. No. I can even picture the kind
of thing. I also bet that would be very, very bad.
Yeah, I could totally picture like just a in the chamber creates a temporary vortex of magnetic energy or something that dissipates after, you know, long enough and then has to go. That I guess that'd also be how lightsabers worked, right?
So we could combine lightsabers and holograms that way.
Go on.
So if you can use like a lot of the hologram technology uses sound waves to sort of keep things, you can use sound waves to make things levitate and stay in one place, right? Mm-hmm. Beads of water, things like that. You can use magnetic fields. You can use sound waves. So you can use those to keep things stationary. You with me? So if you were using that to keep a bunch of, you know, like a bunch of, you know, dust or iron filings or something like that, that were stationary, not moving, then you could heat it up with the laser, microwave them or whatever. You could have this beam that doesn't go beyond 3 feet and you could keep it in a stable place. Now we're looking at right now, they're using ultrasonic waves to keep water droplets stationary.
Yep.
And change the shape, et cetera. So if you had some sort of plasma bubble or whatever, you could certainly make something that looked like, yeah, this is, we don't have the, we have the small parts of this now. We can do this with, you know, 1 centimeter things, but.
Yeah. And you know what? I can actually, I can even envision a galaxy where, you know, you have an amazing scientific society, let's say the core society that figures out all this stuff. And that, for whatever reason, fades out, and yet all of its gifts are still there. And so, as a result, you got so many, you know, I don't know, rudimentary uses for these high end, you know, post singularity technologies.
But and even look at today, if you go to other places like the Middle East or other places that aren't, you know, lesser developed countries and stuff, where people are still using, you know, ox driven carts. People mm-hmm. are still using animal power. People are still burning, you know, manure in their homes to keep it warm. Yet they might have cell phones. Yet they have some of these other technologies. You know, it's this very weird mixed. And that was the expression was the problem of the future is it's distributed unevenly. So because we fall into sort of prey thinking that everybody's like we are right now talking on Skype with Siri and that other thing at our moment, you know, notice and stuff. There are other places that don't have, most of the world actually doesn't have all the latest 21st century technology there. A lot of them don't even have steady power. But airplanes fly overhead. They're in a universe a lot more like a Star Wars universe.
Yeah. So what other technologies, have we covered all the big ones?
No.
I guess hyperspace,
no.
Faster than light travel.
Yeah, we can go. So we got laser pistols. So yeah, let's talk about fast light travel, as you just mentioned. Okay.
That one's tougher.
Go ahead, Brian.
That one's tougher. Tougher to just walk through.
I solved it, guys.
Oh, yeah?
So there are...
Oh, my God.
There is the problem with fast and light travel, and you have to think about it this way. If you're just saying, yes, let's go fast and light, you run into sort of causality violations, which effectively means that you have a time machine as we sort of presently understand it. Because if you're like, oh... If you go faster than X, then you have to be going back in time. And that's sort of the problem is like, how do you have time travel? How do you have, fast and light without having time travel? Because time travel seems to sort of break the universe as far as how things work. Well, there are other ideas in it. There's nothing to say that within certain spots, you can't go what appears to be faster. And all we want to do is we want to get from point A to point B that's, let's say it's 10 light years away, and we don't have to wait 10 years to be able to get there in relative time. There are some views of the universe saying, okay, something may be 10 light years away, but if there is a shorter path from here to there, then there's a difference. And we know this is true because when we look at like gravitational lensing, light can be bent around galaxies and can take a longer path to get from one point to the other because of the distortion of space-time. And if we found out that space was distorted on a microscopic level, on a, you know, on a very, very subatomic level, which some theories say that it is, there's one theory, you know, we talked about the Casimir effect, where if you put two perfectly polished plates right next to each other, it sort of eliminates the sort of like the quantum foam or the little quantum little things that happen in between there. And some theories say that light would travel faster through there.
Huh.
Okay. Right.
So, but some people say that's completely nuts. But the point is you could say, okay, maybe there's a way to get from point A to point B if you sort of had a way to avoid all the little quantum things that sort of slow you down, or the quantum friction or whatever. And you're not going to go, you're still going to be limited by an upper limit. So you're not going to go back in time, but you are going to get there faster than if you just shot a beam of light there directly.
Yeah.
You're not investing, Brian?
Let's just say, and then something happens, and then we get to Star Wars.
I'm just saying, if you look up the Wikipedia and you look at all the different theories that people have been trying to put forward there, and there's new ones, and these are from like physicists. These are people who are really grounded in sort of how the universe is supposed to work. You realize there's a lot of people looking for this, like, yes, this is true here, but if we look at it this other way, and you get into things of, you know, some very, very interesting sort of ideas of what if the universe, you know, because every theory we have is a model. It's a model that tries to explain things, but we understand that things are actually more complex than what they are.
Yeah.
And the idea is saying that it's, you know, maybe there is another way that doesn't break what we know, but it gives you this other approach to it.
Right,
it could all be a simulation, and there could just be a warp drive.
Oh, there you go. Of course. Elon Musk is right.
There we go. You just get the cheat code.
Yeah, that's okay. So in that regard, I'm buying it now. All of a sudden, of course, that's sort of a catch-all. That's for any for anything. The Super Friends universe exists. And
it's an in-game add-on, you know, warp drive. The car's like, we don't have a good theory for how this works. Doesn't matter. Push it.
Yeah.
You know, that was one of the things that I thought Joss Whedon did wonderfully in Firefly. Do you remember how the Firefly universe worked?
It feels like they were going from star system to star system, but instead they left Earth that was, and they just found a extremely planetary full of a bunch of planets, all of which you could get, you know, in a short amount of time, relatively short amount of time from planet to planet, right?
Yeah, big fat solar system, a solar system with a ton of planets. I thought that was a wonderful way to do that, because even now we're looking at our own solar system and, you know, we realize that, like, hey, Earth is cool. You know, Mars with the right atmosphere would be kind of neat. You know, if Venus had some more rotation to it, whatever, and wasn't, you know, hell, Venus could be kind of cool. Jupiter, you've got, you know, some interesting places there. Saturn, you got Titan.
It's a system that had three suns, so that's why you get different colors, or four stars. Wow, that's some complicated math. Five. There's a white dwarf there too. Wow, that's how you tell a story, people. One,
so
two,
if we were on three, surface four. Of Titan, you know, we wouldn't need pressure suits. We'd need some nice something to keep us warm and some oxygen, but we could walk out there without spacesuits.
Yeah, dude, Titan is my favorite world to imagine. I mean, outside of it being cold, it has real rain and thunderstorms and rivers. And granted, it's all alcohol. Is that what it is? Ethanol? Methane.
Methane.
And it's, you know, possible that there's critters living in there.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of an exciting thing to think about. Like, so, you know, Ganymede, of course, you know, which I think, you know, Jupiter thinks that the challenge of Jupiter, of course, is that, like, you need to have a lot of fuel depots to be able to go there. And like the inner ones are, you know, problematic because of the gravity well, but still, you know, and that's, I'm going to touch this back to SpaceX for a moment. The cool thing about the ITS rocket, by the way, which Elon Musk showed some footage of them. I think maybe it was a Merlin engine, but they've got, you know, they're building a rocket, a spaceship that can go there. Build it now. You know, they're like working on this.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah. But I think, you know, that's the hardest part, of course, is fast and light. That's the hardest part about this is the fast light. How do you get there? How do you get there so quickly? How do you, you know, like even the force, we were talking about this a little bit before the show.
How about this? It says it's a galaxy far, far away, long time ago or whatever.
It's a tiny galaxy. Is that what you're getting at?
That is exactly what I'm getting at.
Oh, sorry.
No. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like we don't know the scale, the size of anything. What if it's microscopic and they really can just by jumping to light speed, get from one section to another in that, oh, that's interesting. So, like, let's say it takes about a day at light speed. So imagine it's a galaxy just about the size of our solar system, where you could get from one side of it to the other at light speed in a matter of days.
There are some theories that the speed of light has changed, and it is different in different parts of the universe.
Ooh, that's good. That's good. Yeah. I think that's my favorite explanation so far. Tiny galaxy.
That's one of the theories deals with the idea if you have places that had no dark matter or whatever, there might be, there's the idea of universal inertia. There's a lot of theories that sort of say, okay, we're not going to say relativity is wrong. We're just saying our concept of distance may be wrong.
Yeah.
You know, based on one aspect of it.
All right, I like this. And also a long time – wait, and actually, hold on. Now I'm thinking about it. A long time ago, you know, maybe this occurs in the first few microseconds after the Big Bang. Maybe this happens super fast during the rapidly expanding universe phase.
Well, there was when Lucas wrote Star Wars and he had Han Solo saying that he could, you know, make the jump in like 12 parsecs, people were like laughing because like that's distance, not time. Well, maybe that is what he meant. Maybe the idea is that you found that shorter path that avoided these gravity wells or et cetera, whatever.
Yeah, I think in the expanded universe, they introduced the Kessel Run as you know, a unconventional route would take you through an anomaly where the faster you went, the shorter the distance became. But
yeah, works for me. It's all true. It's a documentary. We all know this.
Yeah, it works for me, man. I'm feeling good about this. I think we've explained all. Oh, I guess the force.
Okay. So you mentioned before the Machu Kiku, you know, the idea of this, you know, we can imagine, you know, a very Victorian Robert Houdin solution to how you could walk into a room and make things move and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you do this when you're out on Hoth, Brian, and the Womp is about to get you and your lightsaber's just out of reach. And by the way, you saw the theater, right? Like me, right? As a kid?
Oh, sure.
Now you have to understand, children, up until that moment in Star Wars lore, you did not know you could move things with the Force.
Yeah, no, the Force was nothing but like a vibe that made you really good at flying, right? Like it made you skilled, like supernaturally fast or precise so that you could block a blaster bolt with your lightsaber. That's about all the Force was good for.
You could like maybe, you know, do a little bit of mind rape on some stormtroopers and stuff. But like that was I mean, Vader could, you know, squeeze his fingers and make you start to choke. But you're like, oh, maybe it's psychology or whatever.
Yeah,
we didn't know. And so we're in this watching Luke stuck there, like hanging like a side of meat as this Yeti's about to eat him. And I'm like, what's he going to do? And I remember that scene as he just reaches towards the lightsaber and that first little wiggle.
It's like, no way.
Like, what just happened?
Can I tell you, did
the movie jump?
I for years, I had the false memory because keep in mind, I saw it when I was, 4 years old, 5 years old. And of course, memories very easily get corrupt. And at the time, I couldn't understand why it was wiggling and moving out. So I confabulated a scene that I was convinced exists in the movie of the lightsaber being on and projecting down into another tunnel where another Wampa was curious and was kind of hitting it and flinching.
A little skeptic.
And that's what was knocking it up. And then finally happened enough that he grabbed it and was able to go nuts. And I don't think I've ever told anyone about that. For 20 years, I'm like, why do I have this very clear memory before I learned how you could easily misremember all that stuff?
Dude, I was – I was on board once that thing flew into his. I'm like, oh, you could do that,
dude. That's for me. That moment was. When the Emperor busted out like lightning bolts. Like, what? You don't even have a lightsaber? What? This is crazy.
That's Jedi, yeah.
New rules.
So, yeah, that moment when that lightsaber moved and jumped into his hands, I'm like, the world shook for me. I'm like, I want to be able to do that.
Well, you know, it's funny. I remember Ryan, who's the guy who's directing 8?
Johnson.
Ryan Johnson, right? He was talking about Looper, that when he was writing the screenplay for Looper, that there was the question of, all right, well, we already have time travel. Do we also want to have telekinesis? And that he always thought it was kind of BS that, you know, that there was this kind of unwritten rule that like one like indulgence means that you cannot have another in terms of science fiction and fantasy writing. And like when you think about it, like Star Wars is kind of great because it matches all those different things together.
Yeah. Well, and I guess it's a lot like as we've come to fall in love with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, like each comic book always had its own kind of set of rules, and yet somehow they coexisted. And we're like, oh, we're in this area where everything could be solved with technology. And like, oh, no, we're over here where magic works. And they've always done a great job of just sort of, you know, when you journey to these different patches in the MCU, different things seem to apply. And I think that's what I'm so excited about, whatever movie's coming out this weekend, is that we're finally traveling to a more militaristic side of the story.
Yeah, so I'll put this thought out there regarding the Force. Is we look at things like drones, we look at things like nanotechnology and AI, and get to the idea of when we start creating invisible things that you cannot see but are still there, you know, and you know, Star Wars was always wonderful because it didn't need these explanations. It didn't need it. It worked without it, but it's fun to do that. But when you start thinking about when you read Peter F. Hamilton books and you start getting into the idea of the post-singularity, if Star Wars was a civilization that took place post-singularity, but they didn't know it, you know, and you had the remnants of that, I think as Brian mentioned there, is that you could have things like, you know, microscopic nanobots and stuff like that that answer to your mind's will and move things and float and make all this sort of stuff happen. But it would appear to be magical.
Yeah. So, in fact, that was that'll be my pick. Is it the Dreaming Void trilogy? Like he figures out a way to tell a fantasy story in a science fiction post singularity world, and the method is that it's a construct by a precursor race in the middle of the galaxy is a supermassive black hole, and inside that black hole are a bunch of planets and stars or create facsimiles thereof, and they have this kind of idyllic you know, medieval kind of lifestyle. They say, you know, they know that they came from a colony ship, but basically it's Game of Thrones in there, and that there are people who can quote unquote long talk to each other, ESP or long arm, you know, move things with their mind, and then somebody even figures out how to turn back time. And of course, and all of this happens by way, and this is a spoiler, but I think it'll help give you a foothold going into it. But the people on the outside of it, it's not magic to them. They're just watching this supermassive black hole get bigger and bigger as it sucks up more and more mass to create all the energy to redraw the whole world backwards, just for the will of that one person. So it ends up balancing the scales and makes a scientific case for how something like that could happen. It's I really dug it.
Well, Brian, that's good. It's good that you have things you like, because there are going to be things you don't like in this next episode of
Journey Quest. Oh, I was about to say, do we say it? Do you say it? I what's going on? I've already had my game face on because I have to defeat Justin in this trivia challenge right here in the Diamond Dome. Otherwise, well, actually, if I was a better person, I'd be figuring out a way for us to team up. But instead, I'm just actually scrolling through my user interface trying to see if there's an English setting so I can cheat on the trivia challenge.
All right, let's
first we
got to
find out who the Dr. Dude is.
Oh, Captain Cool.
Let's back up and tell everybody where we are right now in Journey Quest.
Right now, Brian and Justin have escaped the clutches of the militaristic super government stand-in. They split up because Brian took a willing upgrade of Hitler AI tech
We don't know for sure it's Hitler. It's just German. German engineering can't be beat.
His name's Adolf. You keep Sieg Heiling involuntarily. Justin, disgusted with his partner's actions, struck off on his own, only to be brought in to a desert cult community of what seems to be Diamond Club folks, as they have their supreme leader that organizes these battles, which is the only way to earn money in the community. And now Brian and Justin are face to face in a high stakes trivia contest.
But just at this moment, the mysterious hooded figure, the guy who rules Diamond Town, known by many names, Legion are his names, from Admiral Awesome, Captain Cool. They're just making up all these delightful complimentary names left and right. Seems like he's about to show up here on the scene.
Well, he is now. There was a bunch of lights. The lights dimmed and a platform lowered from up above. And you saw the most awesome leather boots that were like made Kiss boots look like dance shoes. You know, and then leather pants, and then you saw these black, leathery, feathery wings that just stretch from one end of the dome to the other. Metal plating, armor, shoulder pads, just spikes sticking out of everywhere. And then a face mask, this big, huge face mask that's kind of Kabuki style, kind of ROM the Space Knight style, whatever. And there's like smoke coming out of the mouth grill. And there's like just this red glow, just this sort of like just evil, sinister, like demon sort of thing. And the voice is like, "You will now play the trivia challenge." And you're like,
I elbow Justin, and it was like, man, could you imagine with me and my implants, bet if I looked awesome like that, that'd be awesome.
So two guys come running out on their knees to look like midgets, but they're not. But it's just weird because, you know, this.
Wait, they're full grown men pretending to be dwarves by walking around on their knees. They're like dwarf on golf. Like do they have slippers like yogurt and they have capes behind them to hide their legs?
They hand you each buzzers, right?
The buzzers
have little handcuffs on them, too. The handcuffs, like, click around you. So you got the buzzer in your hand. Like, the buzzer's got these cables that go off.
I give mine a test just to see if it works.
And you hear this.
Okay, and I address the crowd.
-5 points, Brushwood.
Oh, okay. Well, I explained to the audience, like, no, I'm not an idiot. It's just that once I was in a trivia contest against Justin.
-10 points. Brushwood.
Well, and I lost because my thing wasn't attached before, and I've never forgotten it.
-5 points, Brushwood. -100 points, electrocution.
All of a sudden, you get a big shock that goes through you, and like,
all right. I could tell when you know, I could read an audience.
Yeah. All right. So all of a sudden, the Admiral of Astounding. Pulls out of his pocket what looked like some Trivial Pursuit cards from Applebee.
Oh, my God.
I squint really hard and see if I can use my enhanced sight to detect which edition of Trivial Pursuit it is.
What was the name of the community the women from Golden Girls lived in? Ooh. In his voice. What was the name of the community the girls from the women in Golden Girls lived in?
Oh, God.
I flinch and act like I'm about to buzz, like I know the answer, but I'm really just trying to psych Justin out into buzzing randomly.
Yeah, Justin takes the pass on that one.
All right, but then I keep doing it. I look over at Justin.
You hear a clock going 10, 9, 8.
I real quick, I say, Adolf, I need help on this one. Do you know the Golden Girls? Adolf.
Being a friend. I don't know. I only know the name in German.
damn. I say, the Golden Girls. The Golden Girls live
Zero.
There.
Both of you get electrocuted. Right? And then you're like, you're on the floor unconscious.
That's okay.
Right? And then you're groggy and you're being kicked by the dwarfs. They're kicking you up and you're like, oh, they're like, next round.
Oh, man. Right?
The Commander Courageous, the King of Cool, next question, pulls out another card. This also looks like an Applebee's Trivial Pursuit card. How many bullets did Barney Fife have in Andy Griffith?
I buzz and I say one.
Correct. Justin gets electrocuted
again.
All right. Now we're entering into the speed round.
This is a fast game. I'm into it now. I start bobbing on my feet, and I'm looking. And I say, "What do you say, crowd? Who's your favorites?"
Also, they're is this actually... all going to be about Nick at Night?
All right, speed round. Finish this sentence. Clarissa knows what?
Justin. It all.
Knows all or it all?
It all.
Is that your final answer?
Yes.
He's like,
is that right? Is
the you question... are correct.
Oh, no.
Ryan gets electrocuted.
And I real quick,
it's
I say,
Clarissa explains it all.
Yeah, she explained it. She didn't know everything. She just talked about it all.
Yeah, you don't want to be the one to explain it to Captain Cool.
Yeah, I'm just gonna go ahead and take the it all.
Somehow Bryce in a hospital on the other side of the country gets electrocuted.
For that, you have to go to the pit.
Wait, who does?
Wait, what?
Both of you.
Damn.
Wrecked the commander.
I didn't. I did not. I thought it in my head. I didn't say
it. You thought it out loud.
God
so you
damn
both
it.
Get shocked and you pass out. Okay. All right. So you get passed out. You wake up. You guys aren't together anymore. You're in separate rooms. You're in small little boxes. Small little boxes.
All right. I say, not knowing if I have this ability yet, I say, Adolf, turn on light eyes.
Nine.
Okay. All right. So I can't shoot light from my eyes. Got it.
Yeah. There's like a bunch of Whoppers wrappers, by the way, on the floor of your box, Brian, because you recognize the smell.
Oh, well, okay. I pat around and see if there's any that can be anything that of value.
There is an old onion ring.
Oh, I eat it quickly.
Okay. That doesn't really have any.
But before I do, I take the onion ring and I do like you do with an orange slice, and to nobody there in the room, I smile as if I'm a boxer wearing a mouth guard. I'm like, come on, you put me, and then I chew it up and eat it.
You do, Justin. You're also inside of a tiny little box.
All right.
Okay, and you're thinking, man, I really should keep my mouth shut.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. Well. Yeah. I mean, I guess we survived, right? The other people that we saw that didn't win got killed. So upside.
All right. So there is a somebody knocks on your cage, Justin, and say, "All right, pick a number between 1 and 10."
5.
Perfect, Tim. Door unlocks. You open it up. Two big, tall dudes there, dressed in like leather armor. Like, all right, come with us. They walk you down a tunnel, okay? Dirt tunnel, dirt sides. You come to a wall, and there's all sorts of weapons there. You've got, okay. But I mean, like, improvised weapons. It might be like a tree, like a branch saw. You see, like, a weed whacker. You see, you know, a garbage can lid. There's, like, a chain from a chainsaw. There's, like, ice skates that have, like, just the ice skate, like, the blades with, like, tape around it so you can use them as sort of some sort of weapon. Like, all right, pick one. And maybe you see something cool I didn't describe. You can tell me if that's there.
I'm going to go with the tree saw.
You're going to go with the tree saw. You're going to go with the tree saw. You ready? You happy with the tree saw?
Yeah.
All right. So you go down to another tunnel. They open up the doors, and you're back in the Diamond Dome.
Okay.
Okay. You're back in the Diamond Dome, and they're like, all right, ladies and gentlemen. A fight to the death.
Oh, geez. So much for that upside.
Yeah. You see this gate on the other side? There's this big, tall gate, right? And these guys come, they start to unbuckle it. They start to unlock the gate. Gate opens up.
Yeah.
And there's a dude who's like 9 foot tall.
Okay.
9 foot tall, but you know his legs are kind of long, kind of like the guy that dresses like Uncle Sam during the 4th of July parades and stuff.
Are they
sure?
They kind of wooden, like maybe
maybe like stilts for like roofer and stilts or whatever like that. Okay, so you got this really tall dude there, right? He's got two baseball bats in either hand with like nails to them.
Okay,
Maybe the stilts are wooden. That's a good point, Brian. It's a very good point. I'm picking up what you're putting down. All right. There's a countdown. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And you just stand there. What's that?
I start charging towards
the... You start charging. I'm
charging towards the man with the stilts. I assume that my quickness needs to be my great advantage against Stilt Man. What I try to do is swing the tree saw while I run around him to see, hopefully the teeth of the saw catch into his stilts so I can try to put, at least pull him off balance.
Okay, so Stilt Man is off balance. You hacked away at the leg like that, and you feel like a bat just sort of like grazed your back, like a nail sort of grazed your back.
Okay.
But you roll to the side, but Stilt Man kind of just managed to get back a little back upright now. Okay.
Okay.
And he stands there again.
I try the same maneuver, except this time on the other side, I try to go after the other leg.
He's like, oh, you know, it was weird, intelligible sound.
I feel like Stilt Man is holding like two bats over his head, like just holding him way up and jumping up and down.
Like Stilt Man is like, Stilt Man maybe is he toying with him? Is he just toying with Justin, just getting him to attack him? Is that what you're saying? Because that's what it sounds like you're describing Stilt Man as doing. Stilt Man has the bats. He could just waste Justin right now, but he doesn't. And so obviously, clearly, he's just doing a toy with him, you know?
Yeah.
That's
and I'm going to make him pay for that kind of. That kind of insolence. And so I again go after him, and this time I try to permanently damage his stilt.
So you go after you just hack into like with the right stilt or the left stilt.
I tried the right one first, and now I go after the left one.
All right. So all of a sudden you've damaged that stilt, and Stilt Man's hopping around on one stilt, right?
Then Stilt Man looks like his eyes get really wide, like he has an idea. And he takes his right hand bat and holds it up to his left shoulder and then points straight out towards the sky. And he keeps repeating the gesture as if he's trying to communicate something non-verbally about who's inside the stilt costume.
Justin rolls his eyes in such a slow and deliberate motion that everybody in the Diamond Dome is also simultaneously disgusted. I drop the saw and I attempt to push Stilt Man over so I can help remove the stilts that are tied to
him. Realizing that he only has one stilt to stand on, but is holding two baseball bats, Stilt Man realizes he can walk like an awesome tripod and leans over and uses his arms as more legs as he walks around the arena as a three-legged giant sloth man.
Frustrated by the fact that Stilt Man is not comprehending that Justin is trying to free him from his stilts, Justin then again rolls his eyes and just points at Stilt Man and says, oh my God, this guy, right?
How does the crowd react to that? Stilt Man looks up at the crowd to see if they like that.
Oh, they're not happy. They're throwing stuff at you. They're booing you. They want to fight to the death. They're just like, what is this dumb Cirque du Soleil? What's going on?
All right. So Stilt Man realizes that the only way we're going to get out of this is if we put on a good enough show that they think we're fighting. So Stilt Man charges to one side, as a tripod, turns back around, rears up, looks at Justin, and using his right cudgel, scrapes the ground a few times as if a bear or a bull about to charge.
Justin looks at Stilt Man and says, for real, though, this guy.
All right. Stilt Man charges towards Justin and not wanting to physically injure him, but at least, keep us from being booed to death, charges into him, puts down his head and just sort of tackles Justin, knocks him over as he, very gingerly tries to make it look like he trampled him, but actually doesn't hurt him at all. And then as he goes by, he muffles like, and then keeps on going because he's talking through a gag.
Justin, in the shortest amount of words possible, tries to explain to Brian that what we want is for guards to come out and either try to kill us so we can create an escape route for ourselves.
Okay. Nodding. Stiltman gets up. He doesn't get up.
All of a sudden, there's an air horn. Goes off. Air horn, right?
Okay.
Oh. You're like, what do we do now? And you see up above, you see the platform start to lower again, but you don't see the boots. You just see this big black wall, and it has like diamond symbol there, glowing, flashing, strobing. And then you start to hear this, a really, really, but like a really cool kind of bass track start to play. And it keeps going back. And it's the tallest DJ booth you've ever seen with two turntables. And guess who is mixing it? None other than the supreme super dude of Diamond Town is now mixing it up and playing some fat, fat music for you all.
Is he doing any live switching at the same time?
You do notice overhead there are some projection screens that have been showing some very topical comments as you've been doing this fight. Sloths, things like that, whatever. He's like, keep it up, boys. Keep it up.
Oh, my God. That's gotta be. I just look up and in a quizzical look, I'm like, Bryce?
What's up, nerds?
He's like, but it's crazy, Bryce. It's Bryce who has gone through, seen some stuff. Bryce ain't Bryce anymore. Bryce has gone through a bit of a. This is evil Bryce.
All right.
So remember, I killed a lot of children.
I tried desperately to appeal to Bryce's, the man that Bryce was before, by looking him dead in the eyes. Pointing at Brian and saying, but for real, this guy, right?
All right. Tripod Stiltman gets over and puts his face, leans it forward to Justin and kind of gestures as if, you know, please remove the mouth gag because I have an idea.
All right.
Bryce has at his disposal, by the way, water cannons. He's got people with sticks that can stab you and electrocute you. He has guys with armed machine guns, and he maybe has some devious plan for all of this. Have you thought about that?
So with the gag removed,
I still remove the gag.
I say, look, keep fighting. I have an idea, and then I kind of push him forward, right? And then, as I get over his body, I raise a fist and look to the crowd, who hopefully is cheering for me. I say, we have to make him remember. And then I slam down, but just to the side of Justin's head.
Okay.
And then I say, and then I turn I offer my battle cry. I stand up on the one leg and throw my two cudgels in the air and say, it's go time, and then start charging at Justin again. As if to intimate that if we give enough cues of the life he once remembered, perhaps some of his sanity.
You just see Bryce, the music sort of stops for a moment there, and his hand goes over to a switcher, and then he just goes back to mixing up the beats there. And by the way, the whole crowd, the whole Diamond Town crowd around the Diamond Dome, they are electrified. You see, they're looking at him like he is a god. He is a god to them, and you're just insects.
Live from Diamond Dome. It's the
fight dedicated.
Best fight in the world since 1776. I'm gonna kill my BFF JRY.
For some reason, this is making Bryce more angry.
Yeah. How is this what he would remember? How are we jogging his memory by actually trying to kill each other?
It's called muscle memory. Brian,
now all of a sudden, like he's. Increases the volume on the bass and it's getting louder and louder and it's actually like a weapon. You're feeling your inside, your gut start to liquefy.
All right, there's only one way, Brian, that we can survive this.
And we'll find out next week on Journey Quest.
Right on.
Somebody, I like people are congratulating themselves for figuring it out. There are only four people here.
I put it on the Reddit after last week's episode, asking who people thought it would be, and the very first person who commented definitely called it and said it would be me.
That's amazing. What I love is that you're defending. You're explaining why it can't be you. You're like, well, it says you're my pick. You're like, no. Technically, I was canonically.
Well, look, I had to keep the mystery going.
Hey, man, do you guys want to do picks?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, if I fell behind because I was actually going to try to get voiceover from Tom Merritt.
Oh, that would have been amazing.
That was my call. I thought it was either Tom or Scott.
Yeah. It's too lazy.
My pick is The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Thankfully, now Netflix allows you to download their programs. So perfect for flights. I watched half of the first season or the second season, which I had not yet seen on the plane. I'm just in love with that writing, that 30 Rock style, kind of rapid fire, very silly. I think that show being on Netflix just gives them the ability to get into weirder, darker things that they might not have otherwise, and it is obviously kind of a weirder, darker show to hang it on. So I've loved it so far.
How does the second season stand up to the first?
I think it's as good.
I would imagine maybe even. I guess I was thinking it might be better just because, you know, the first season was a bit disjointed in that it started off as a product for broadcast television, but then became a Netflix original in the writing and development. But second season, you know, they knew what they were going to be from the beginning.
Yeah, and you start to see those hallmarks there, and you know, for a show that, you know, cast a John Hamm as a wacky charismatic cult leader, you know, this is very, very, very much in that same vein. It's awesome.
That was such a great part of the first season.
Well, especially not knowing. I don't know how they managed to keep that from being like the headline across the board, because that moment of recognize and you see him all, you know, crazy Mansoned out for a while, and then it's when he's cleaned up, you're like, what?
Yeah.
And of course, and then he nails it with the way he seduces the jury and everything.
You're thinking like, and he's like any evil rapist person, horrible, but he's like, oh, he's very charming. Like, wait a second.
Just his like screwball. Like, I think that's it. I mean, like, the show is really about these like kind of fairly dark kind of like survivor themes, but like, it is just the screwballiest of screwball comedies, which is amazing.
Yeah, so let me double check that. I believe it's called the Dreaming Void series from Peter F. Hamilton. Dreaming Void. Loved it. I thought it was a lot of fun. And this is some people may be interested to know. We've previously talked about the two books, Pandora's Star and Judas Unchained. This is the same universe as those two books, but 1,000 years later. And because it's a post-singularity universe, a few people are still alive in various forms from back then.
My pick is I was looking around for something on Amazon Prime to watch. So you know what? Like every few years I go watch these movies. I'm going to go watch them again because I think that in retrospect, they don't get as much respect as maybe they should, because sometimes when people talk about them, their version of what they remember isn't as accurate as I think is what they actually were. And it's important to understand why they did so well. And particularly, you know, understand like, and it's helpful too when you think about plot. And I am talking about the Rocky movies.
Oh, wow.
If you go back and watch, I actually started to, you know what, I haven't seen Rocky II in forever. So when I watched Rocky II, which was a solid follow-up, actually written and directed by Stallone, which is a solid follow-up and says, okay, let's go to the next step with the story. Rocky III, you know, had some silly sort of moments, but still was sort of a very interesting, that was where he fought Mr. T and sort of like, how do you do the story? Rocky IV was a perfect 80s movie, you know, Rocky versus Ivan Drago, you know, and it is cheesy on many levels, but it's also like you go, man, that's the movie it needed to be for that time and era. Rocky V is, you know, the weakest of them of it because they're trying to figure out where to go. But still, one of the things you appreciate about this, about the character of Rocky, is that, and you go back and you watch Rocky I, or Rocky as it was called, and you appreciate the fact of how funny Rocky was. Rocky was a likable character, how likable he was even in the first one where he's a guy who's doing a – he's working doing collections, a leg breaker, you know, for the mob, and how he's just this sad life. You see his apartment and just realize this is a guy that kind of was never going to get his shot, tried to be a good guy, but just because of circumstances it was hard. But it was a lot of – that character was just a very well-done character. And Talia Shire's character, really well done. That story of what it's about, and people, and you get into like sports movies and you get hung up on the idea of, well, how many times can you watch somebody win? But when you go to the Rocky movies, particularly, you know, he doesn't win most of the matches. You know, it's usually about the underdog and trying to get to a point where even just, you know, breaking even can make a big deal, which is what made Rocky Balboa. And it's not about what happens, it's about how it happens. And so when you're telling a story, you can say, people, I have this discussion, I've been doing a lot of Periscope sessions, be like, how do I do something that's, you know, all the ideas have been done, which one is not true. And two, it's how you tell a story. It's how you tell it. And we've had a lot of boxing movies. Rocky, I think, is still the best boxing movie there is.
Well, and really my theory on sports movies is I think the best ones are the ones that really use the DNA of the game to tell the story. And boxing, you know, so much of it is the hype of the story of who these people are, and we're going to settle this conflict, and then they are going to go in their own separate directions. You know, hyping up a fight is something that it, you know, just got the UFC to sell their corporation for billions of dollars. And Rocky is just the canonical example of that, almost even on a meta level, as Apollo Creed is like, oh, no, wait. Like, he recognizes the idea that Rocky could be a good fight for him to kind of just further his brand, really. I mean, the idea of Apollo Creed as a character and Rocky as a foil for him in the first two films specifically is just, like, so prescient for not only that boxing at that time, but also, you know, just – all of as big as fighting kind of got in the intervening 50 years.
I'm going to take a dissenting point of view. If you go back and you watch the first Rocky movie, Creed is there, but Creed is an opportunity. But Creed, it's so much about this guy who's this, you know, had a bunch of hard breaks and maybe not made the best choices in life. It's a you get more time with the romance between him and the, you know, Talia Shire's character, who's this shy, you know, people call her retarded because she's so shy kind of girl. Rocky's stuck working for the mobster and this sort of stuff. I would say that it's not that you found out that he liked to do amateur night, you know, drama, and he got a chance to do an audition for Juilliard or something. And that story still worked. I would say that part of what it works is it's not the other one, certainly the other like two and three and all that, certainly, yes, get into that hype. And I'd say that was a problem of five. It was just like the character, the Don King character, is clearly Don King. But I would say probably the reason Rocky worked was just it didn't feel like a sports movie.
Well, I guess, you know, what I'm trying to you know, draw a circle around, and probably doing it poorly, is just the idea that hyping a boxing match is about the story. And the more organically you can do it, the better it is. The more that people can in their hearts have a rooting interest in a fight is kind of the seed to that. And that was such a beautiful story to tell of this guy who's like, you know, kind of a lunkhead, and but he wants, you know, he's as pure at heart as we are assuming his environment allows, you know. So I don't know, but you're right. It is so much a, you know, those performances are not certainly beholden to sports, but I think that the inherent tale of a fighter's journey culminating in a fight is so ingrained in it that it, you know, it was just so poetically done in that movie.
Well, that is my pick. You've got Rocky 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 are on Amazon Prime. And then I thought Rocky Balboa, a little bit on the short side, was a great kind of like, you know, capstone to that story. And then with Creed was such a great, you know, launch of this. And you know, where do you go from the story there? And very excited to see what happens to the Creed saga. Because you realize, you go back and you look at the evolution of Apollo Creed's character in there, you know, where he's, and even in the first Rocky, he's not a bad guy. He's an opportunistic guy. but he's not really the villain so much. You know, he's a guy that Rocky has this respect for, even because Rocky's realized how, you know, Rocky defends Creed because he sees, you know, he appreciates the guy that he tried to be bigger and better and whatever. And that's what made sort of the friendship that developed between them, I thought, is you watch them all in sequence, you go like, yeah, this is genuine and this is real. And then you go watch Creed, you know, from Balboa, you appreciate it even more of what, you know, that meant. And that's one of the things I loved about that story, was it would have been very easy to make Creed into the bad guy, but he wasn't. He was just the champion trying to, you know, do what he was going to do. And, you know, yeah, I thought that, you know, Rocky would be a cinch, but turned out to be otherwise. So it's my pick.
So great.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.